There we go. Well, thank you very much for the invitation, and I know it's a holiday, so thank you all the more for coming to hear me. So I'd like to talk today about a topic that has a lot of aspects in various different fields, and I'm going to try to give some sort of survey of a number of the developments. It's progressed quite a lot in the past few years, and I think there's a lot of interesting, exciting problems. So let me give you, start off with some definitions, and what I'm going to try to do is give you sort of a good survey of, as I say, a number of the things that have happened. So first of all, a definition. So a manifold, MG, is called conformally compact. If, M is a manifold of boundary, and the metric G has a very special form. So it's going to be a metric only defined on the interior of M, and it's modeled after the Poincaré ball. So it looks the form rho to the minus 2 times G bar. So the picture here is that MG bar is, let's say, a smooth metric. So G bar is non-degenerate up to the boundary, and rho is equal to a defining function for the boundary. Excuse me? Which is rho, no. So, well, I mean, of course, it occurs in here, but the point is G does not canonically determine rho, and that's, in fact, quite the point. So this is just a definition. As I say, it's motivated by the simplest case where G bar is, well, M is the ball, G bar is the Euclidean metric, and rho is 1 minus mod x squared over 2, and then you have just the hyperbolic metric. So these are meant to be some sort of rough approximation of these. And you can check that certain properties still hold. So these are complete. This power here, minus 2, is just the critical one. So these are just complete. If I had any larger power, they wouldn't be. If anything more, then the curvature would blow down to minus infinity. So these have bounded negative curvature, at least near when rho is small. In the interior, they can be doing more or less anything. So this has been an interesting class of objects. They've been around for about the last 15 years or so, and there's a large set of problems that one can do on these. So there are a lot of natural examples. So for example, if I take a quotient of hyperbolic space where gamma is what's called convex co-compact, geometrically you should be thinking of hyperbolic manifolds with large ends. So they're flaring out exponentially. Essentially, this means it's geometrically finite and there are no cusps, so no ends which are finite volume, for example. A little bit more technical than that. These are examples of such things. Anyway, there's a large class of things that people have studied on these manifolds, including the scattering theory, and there's sort of a huge subject attached to this now. I'm going to go off in a slightly different direction and define another specialization here. So MG is called Poincaré-Einstein. If it is conformally compact in Einstein. So I'm looking at manifolds of this type which satisfy this extra rather stringent curvature condition. So let me remind you, Einstein here means that the Ricci curvature of G is going to be some constant times the metric G, and the usual normalization we take here is minus n times G. This is, I'm always going to be taking n plus one dimensional manifolds. So this is the normalization. This is, in fact, exactly what hyperbolic space itself satisfies. So these are some sort of analog of hyperbolic space. Now, this may seem like a rather arbitrary thing to study, but I'll start off by saying a few motivations for why people were interested in these in the first place. So there were two main things, one a long time ago and one much more recently. So the first one was work of Sefferman and Graham in the mid-80s, say around 85. And I'll say it in words, but essentially the idea, and I'll have to explain what I mean by going back to the form of this metric, is that you want to associate a canonical Riemannian structure to a conformal structure. So in this picture, as I'll show you in just now, the boundary of M inherits a natural conformal structure. And Fefferman had been studying analogous things for strictly pseudoconvex domains in CN, for example. And there, if you have a CR structure, it fills in naturally with a Kähler-Einstein metric. And so the hope is to do something similar in the real case. Namely, one would like to start off with conformal geometry and somehow fill it in with a canonical Riemannian metric. Now, what is the conformal structure here? Excuse me? No, this is Riemannian. Of course, you can think of these things as submanifolds of the Lorentzian space, but it's not necessary. So exactly as Victor had pointed out, this function rho is not canonically associated. So if I start off with one of these conformally compact metrics G, and I choose any defining function rho, then I can look at rho squared times G. This is G bar. And then I can pass from there to G bar restricted to the boundary. Well, that's not a very well-defined map because I could take, I mean, G is the thing I'm given, but I could change rho by any positive smooth function. So I could have also replaced rho by A times rho, and this would give me A rho squared G, which is A squared G bar, and this goes to A squared G bar on the boundary. So the moral of this is that only the conformal structure of G bar on the boundary is well-defined. G bar itself isn't. So this is called the conformal infinity map. So starting with any one of these metrics, so this maps G to the conformal structure, G bar restricted to boundary M. This just means the set of all positive smooth multiples of this. Okay, so conformal geometry is a sort of a rich subject, which is parallel in many ways to Riemannian geometry, but, well, it's just different. It's a lot looser. And in some sense, what motivated Fefferman towards this was the problem of constructing invariants. So given Riemannian geometry, there's a classical theorem that goes back to Hermann Weyl, which is, says that you know any scalar Riemannian invariant comes about by taking the curvature tensor and its covariant derivative and taking complete contractions of them, and you get numbers. And these are the only geometrically invariant numerical invariants you can get from a Riemannian metric. Okay, the reason that works is because underlying the Riemannian geometry is the special orthogonal group, and it's compact. In conformal geometry, the underlying group isn't compact, and there's just no such process to do this. Okay, so his idea was essentially that if we start off with a conformal structure, then, well, we'd like to somehow fill it. Now, there are a lot of reasons that I won't go into why this kind of funny filling is a reasonable thing to try, but here's the boundary of M. We'd like to first fill it topologically and then find some sort of natural metric which associates this. And it turns out that the Einstein condition, well, it's certainly a very natural Riemannian condition, and in a certain sense, this is a well-posed problem. So let me phrase what this program should be a little bit differently. So I'm going to let E of M be the space of all Poincaré Einstein metrics on this manifold M, metrics on M. C of boundary M being the set of all conformal classes on the boundary. And what I've defined here is what's called the conformal infinity map, which maps E of M to C of boundary M. And the question that, in some sense, he wanted an affirmative answer to is this map a bijection, or how far from a bijection is it? I mean, is it one-to-one? Is it onto? You can ask various questions like this. Now, one can phrase this purely as a PDE problem. The Einstein equation is a second-order problem. If you choose an appropriate gauge, it becomes elliptic. But because of this completeness of the metric, it's a degenerate elliptic problem, if you think about it. I'll write that up in some more detail in a few minutes. And so another problem that you can think about, which is somewhat analogous, is suppose you take hyperbolic space. And suppose you take an arbitrary smooth or continuous or whatever function on the boundary. So take any continuous function on the sphere. Natural question is there a harmonic function u? So it's supposed to satisfy this, and u restricted to the boundary is equal to phi. So this is a boundary problem in hyperbolic space. It's a little bit of a funny boundary problem from a standard point of view because the boundary here is not really there. It's off at infinity. So this is an asymptotic boundary problem. To even make sense of this, you have to put a, well, you have to compactify hyperbolic space, and then you have to put a topology on that so that you can say that what it means for you to be continuous up to the boundary. So this is all possible, and it's fairly classical. And if you're doing this on hyperbolic space itself, then there's actually a concrete representation formula. Not surprisingly, there's a Poisson representation formula. So in some sense, I want to think of this as some sort of ideal boundary problem or some sort of asymptotic boundary problem that's nonlinear. And, well, so that's a PDE way of thinking about this question. It's a nonlinear asymptotic boundary problem. And that's ultimately how one has to approach it. Now, as I say, there's a good chance that this is at least roughly speaking true, and I'll indicate some formal calculations that occurred in this paper of Pfeffermann and Graham from the mid-80s, where they tried to solve it in some sense using the Fuchsian method, using power series. And in some sense, given a conformal structure in the boundary, there is a way of continuing it to all orders to be a formal solution. Now, whether it actually extends to be an exact solution or how non-unique it may be is a subject of, well, we still don't know quite. Well, it does sometimes and it doesn't other times. But at least from a formal level, it looks like this should be a well-posed problem. Okay, so this is one motivation. And as I say, ideally, in the end, Pfeffermann wanted to associate conformal invariance to this canonical filling metric. And there's actually been some very pretty progress in that in the past few years, which I'll get to later in the talk. So that program is sort of borne fruit. Okay, the second thing is, well, coming out of string theory. So this is, I guess, what was originally called the Maldacena correspondence, or it's also gone by the name of ADS-CFT correspondence. I'm going to say very little about this because I understand very little about the technicalities of it. But basically, the point is that, I mean, it's the same kind of issue that one wants to build quantum field theories on the interior of this manifold, and the correspondence is supposed to be that to any appropriate field theory that you build on the interior, there's supposed to be associated a field theory, a conformal field theory on the boundary. And so again, that this is what Witten had been hoping, is that there's going to be a canonical correspondence between these nice metrics in the interior, these Einstein metrics, and these conformal structures on the boundary. Okay, so this has sort of led to, I mean, if you look in the archives, there's, you know, several dozen papers on this stuff, well, probably more over the past couple of years. And, you know, like so many of these things, they had all this wonderful intuition about what should be true, and only gradually some of it sort of being proved. And, well, some of it's true, some of it's not. But this has led to a sort of quite a lot of progress. Okay, so these are the two motivations for why to study these things. Okay, so what I want to talk about is, well, three or four separate topics. Let me just list them here. So, talk a little bit about existence and some of the analytic machinery which is needed to study these problems. Very closely related is the regularity theory. In the form of asymptotics of the solution. Let's see what else I want to talk about here. And, well, I should also mention at the same time uniqueness. It's very closely bound up in this. And then various applications. Let me just say obstructions to existence applications. So this is where I'm going next, rest of the talk. Okay, well, first of all, let me talk about the very simplest type of existence one could try to prove, which is a perturbative one. So you start with a known solution, and you try to perturb from it. So let me just, in fact, start with what one would try to do, just to show you what goes into this. Okay, so let's start with a known solution. Mg is in this moduli space. And we'd like to know, what are the nearby points? So the basic question you might ask is this script E of M a Banach manifold, or, you know, in some appropriate completion, or does it have singularities? I should say that in the compact case, if you have a smooth manifold without boundary, then the space Feinstein matrix is finite dimensional, but it's quite potentially, and in some known examples, a mess. I mean, it's some real analytic subset of a, you know, some finite dimensional real analytic subset, and it's really not very well understood, except for in some special cases. Okay? As usual with boundary problems, one has a lot more flexibility here, and there's a hope that one can do better. And in fact, I'll say in just a minute, you can. So what one would like to do is to modify G by adding on a tensor H, which is hopefully not going to swamp the singularity of G. So, for example, G has this, well, let me introduce some notation now. Let me call this K here. Let me introduce some notation here. So I'm going to fixate defining, so given G, here's a lemma. It's really an ODE lemma. So given G and a representative, so let's call this H naught, which is a representative for the conformal infinity of G. So G determines a conformal structure at infinity, and I choose a particular metric in there. Okay. Then, well, one solves a singular ODE, and you can always write G in the following form, gx squared plus h over x squared. This is something like normal coordinates around the hypersurface. Okay, so I still have this 1 over x squared behavior. If I were omitting that, then it would say that this x is just a normal coordinate system. So this h is a family of metrics on the boundary. So sort of think of the level sets, x equals constant as a bunch of parallel hypersurfaces. And the metric, the gradient lines of x are all perpendicular to these things here metrically. Okay, and then I have this extra factor, 1 over x squared. Okay, this choice of x actually depends, though, on this h naught. This sort of gives you boundary conditions if you solve off. Okay, so what you'd like to do is study the perturbation problem, namely, you'd like to know when are nearby metrics of this form, again, in this moduli space. Well, you study the linearization. So, you know, first, if you ask when is the Ricci of G plus H plus N times G plus H, think of this as something, excuse me, I call this K here. Excuse me, I also forgot to tell you. So this H here is the family of metrics on the boundary, and at X equals 0, it's this initial one, H naught. Okay, so this is my nonlinear operator. K goes to this combination of things. The Ricci curvature, if you don't remember what it is, it's a mess. It's a bunch of second derivatives of this. You know, there's some nonlinear bits, there's some linear bits, and it's pretty pointless to write out. It's not very comprehensible. Geometrically, it's doing something fairly simple. It's a certain partial average of the sectional curvatures. Okay, and what it is it's something that's sort of the same size as K. So K is a symmetric 2 tensor. And this is, again, a symmetric 2 tensor as this. Okay, so this is my operator, n of k. Well, this, and I can take the linearization, dn sub 0. And, well, unfortunately, the answer here is, again, a bit of a mess. So let me just point out this. So this is some second-order operator, and it has two bad defects. The first is that it's not elliptic. And the second thing is that it's degenerate at x equals 0. Okay. The lack of ellipticity is something that one counters even in the compact situation. And it follows because there's a diffeomorphism group acting on all of this. So if I have any metric which is Einstein, then I pull it back by a diffeomorphism. It's still Einstein. So the solution for that is the usual sort of thing. If I think of G as a point in the space of all metrics, then the orbit through that point of the diffeomorphism group, so diff applied to G. So here's the orbit. It's some sort of infinite dimensional manifold. And what I'd like to do is choose a gauge which is perpendicular to the orbit at that point. And if I only look at perturbations in that direction, for example, that's one way of recovering ellipticity. Anyway, there are various ways to think about this, but this is a very standard procedure at this point in time. So this is not a serious issue. This one is, you can't gauge it away. I mean, it's a real thing. And just to give you some sense of how degenerate it is, well, ideally, if you choose the right gauge, namely by restricting to some slice transversal to the orbit, this operator becomes elliptic. And what it looks like in the end is something like the hyperbolic Laplacian. So it's going to look like the rough Laplacian minus 2, so this thing here, and minus 2 times a certain scalar term. This is some tensor, this is some linear transformation that comes out of the full curvature tensor. And, well, that's it. But what does del star del look like if I write it out in coordinates? So if I were to write out this del star del in coordinates, it looks something like, you know, x squared d by dx squared plus x squared times the boundary Laplacian, let's see, the Laplacian with respect to the metric 8, 0, and then plus terms that look essentially like x d by dx plus x d by dy plus zeroth order terms. So this is what's called a uniformly degenerate operator. An elliptic uniformly degenerate operator. And the thing to observe is that it has a natural scaling structure built into it. So this is equal to an elliptic combination of the basic vector fields x d by dx and x d by dy j, and the y's here are some choice of coordinates on the boundary. They're fairly arbitrary. Okay, so I'm taking, if you like, the sum of squares of these vector fields. Okay, that's what an elliptic combination means. I mean, some elliptic polynomial of these basic vector fields. So the problem is these basic vector fields degenerate fully on the boundary. They vanish. So it's not elliptic in a normal sense. And so one can't apply standard elliptic theory to understand this. Anyway, there's a somewhat long story about how one goes about this, but I'll sort of bypass most of the details here. Let's just say that so one can find a good microlocal theory. In which I embed this. By which I mean there's a space of pseudo differential operators, and one can construct parametrices for these operators. One can prove, well, mapping properties, which may or may not be Fredholm. Often these operators are not Fredholm. You can have, well, besides just being not Fredholm in the usual way of having non-closed range, it can have closed range, but in infinite dimensional kernel or co-kernel. Various other pathologies can happen. And one also wants regularity theory, and for solutions of this sort of operator near the boundary, one expects some sort of asymptotic expansion, but with perhaps strange coefficients, non-integral coefficients. So these are the sorts of things that one expects from this, but there it is. Okay, so getting back to our original perturbation problem here, The perturbation theory should follow just immediately from the implicit function theorem once we find good spaces on which this operator is hopefully surjective. That's all you need. So one would like some sort of function space so that this operator, let me call it L, which is dn at k equals 0, you want this to be a map from, well, let me call it, well, let me write it this way. So x to the nu times c2 alpha 0 of s2 t star m to x to the new c0 alpha 0 of s2 t star m. So f2 t star m are just symmetric 2 tensors. So this is the bundle on which things are living. These are some Holder spaces. The 0 here denotes that one actually has to use Holder spaces which are naturally adapted to these degenerate vector fields. This is, again, not too surprising. And then one wants to look at weighted versions of these spaces. So you look at any function in here and multiply it by the fixed function x to the nu. So this gives you functions with some uniform rate of growth or decay. So nu is allowed to be positive or negative here. So ideally, for the confines of our problem here, what would we like to do? We'd like to choose nu to be larger than minus 2, right? The reason is because we add on to g, so g is degenerating like 1 over x squared, we want to add on something less severe. Well, at least greater than or equal to minus 2. Okay, if we add on something that's blowing up exactly like order minus 2, then what would that do? Well, I mean, if it's something small, then it's going to slightly perturb the boundary value here. And that's in some sense exactly what we'd like to do. We'd like to, I guess of erase things here. We'd like to start off with G having some conformal infinity, and we'd like to say that all nearby conformal infinities are realized, right? That we can find Poincaré-Einstein metrics which have those as their conformal infinities. So the nub of the matter is to know whether or not this operator is surjective, and this follows out of this microlocal theory that, in the end, this is, well, essentially surjective always. Essentially means that it might miss by a finite dimensional amount. So except for this possible finite dimensional amount, rho is going to win. This is always a well-posed problem. We can perturb the conformal structure a little bit, and this does it. Well, so this was proved in a series of papers sort of widely separated in time. And the first paper was in the late 80s, following the Fefferman and Graham work. I'll just list the names here. So Graham and Lee in about 89. Olivier Picard considered this again probably in about 99. And Mike Anderson finally proved the right theorem. So these were perturbation results in slightly increasing levels of generality. And Anderson sort of adapted this argument a little bit and says and proved that E of M is always a smooth manifold. Let's say with respect to this Hülter completion, a smooth Banach manifold. So this really now sets the stage for what we want to do, right? We have the smooth manifold of operators, and in fact, he could say something about this mapping. So this was the main object of study here, this mapping from EM to C of boundary M, this conformal infinity mapping. This is a Fredholm mapping between Banach manifolds. Okay, so that's in some sense saying that if you have any solution at all, then at least up to some finite dimensional amount, this is sort of a locally well-posed problem. There may be many sheets collapsing down onto one thing, and I'll give you sort of a slightly more accurate picture of how that happens in a few minutes, but this is sort of a well-posed problem from this point of view. So what's the ultimate proof of this? Well, it's all pretty soft, and it's along the lines of this stuff. I mean, you have to use the implicit function theorem instead of the inverse function theorem, but, you know, there it is. You just have to set things up appropriately. Now, it turns out that in dimension 4, one can say a good deal more. So suppose the dimension of M is 4. Then it turns out that there's a much more satisfactory existence theory. The reasons for this are essentially that the Ricci tensor, the Einstein condition, controls the, or is very closely related to the Gauss-Bonnet integrand. And so that says that, well, if you have a sequence of Einstein metrics in four dimensions, nothing too horrible happens to it. So they're good, at least under a few mild bounds, they're good compactness criteria for Einstein metrics in four dimensions. So they can collapse, but only in very simple ways. So roughly speaking, here's the theorem that, so this is again a theorem of Anderson's. So I'm going to let C plus of boundary M be the set of, they call them scalar positive conformal classes. So these are conformal classes which contain a metric that has everywhere non-negative scalar curvature. This is a rather interesting class that, it's known to have topological obstruction, so not every three manifold in this case has any conformal classes that satisfy this criteria. It's a rather rigid topological condition. And if you have a manifold which does have them, then in some sense most conformal classes will not be of this type. I mean, this is an open set, but it's in some sense a very restrictive open set. Okay, I can look at the preimage of this. And so these are the set of Poincaré-Einstein metrics with conformal infinity of the special type. And what Anderson proved was that this map is proper. So this is actually really a wonderful advance over this because, in fact, if you have a proper Fredholm mapping, there's a z-valued degree. So you can get existence theory via, essentially, Lorentz-Schauder degree theory. So this means that there exists z-valued degree. Now, I should point out this notion of having a scalar positive boundary seems a bit arbitrary at this point. Why is this necessary? In some sense, this is one of these suggestions that Witten had made, that this is in some sense physical stability. So corresponding to these field theories, having a scalar positive boundary is in some sense what, you know, the only ones that physicists are really interested in. So anyway, fortunately, it's the one that lines up with where the mathematics works out nicely. So this is the set of conformal classes on the boundary such that, you know, any conformal class is in it if some metric in that conformal class is Yamabe positive, has a positive scalar curvature metric. This is on the boundary. This is only metrics on the boundary. This is only conformal classes on the boundary, right? And these things are fillings of them. These are Poincaré-Einstein fillings of these things. Yeah. It is, so the way you define this degree is you look at this Fredholm mapping, and because it's proper, any point has only a finite number of preimages, right? And you look at this linearized mapping, and it has, you can prove it has only a finite number of negative eigenvalues at each preimage. So what you do is you take minus one to the number of negative eigenvalues, and you sum that up over preimages. So the picture you should think of is, following. So here's the moduli space, and it's mapping down to here. So here's C plus, here's E plus. So, you know, this is the usual free theory. But so in some sense, what's happening at each point, you know, you only have a finite number of preimages, and you're just adding up plus or minus ones at each of these things. The Fredholm index here is different. So in general, in this kind of generality, if you don't know it's proper, you don't know that there's any. I mean, there's a local Fredholm index, which is, in fact, it was zero. Yeah, excuse me. So it was zero, because this comes from a sort of a morally self-adjoint problem. So, right, so it's, you know, in some sense, this misses exactly these points. And, well, I sort of hid some stuff here. This, if there's a finite dimensional co-kernel here, it comes about purely because you're right at one of these folds in the projection. Yeah, thanks. Okay, so what this means is that anytime you can identify one Poincaré-Einstein metric that has a scalar positive conformal infinity, you get a very good existence theory from that. So some examples that follow from this, well, if you take the four ball with the hyperbolic metric, G hyperbolic, this satisfies these criteria, namely, it's the conformal infinity of this is the standard metric on the sphere. It's certainly scalar positive. And that means that, well, if you can compute this degree and it's non-zero, then in the whole connected component of scalar positive metrics, right, you get existence theory in that whole component. So the issue is, can you compute the degree here? So what you need is a uniqueness theorem. And in this case, so if you have the standard conformal class in the boundary, namely the round metric and the three sphere, is there a unique way to fill it? And the answer is yes. Okay, so that actually allows you to compute the degree at one regular point. It's one, and that means that you get a, you know, in some sense, a semi-global existence result. Okay, so there are a long list of examples that Anderson was able to compute, and again, this is sort of one of these great things. These are certain types of metrics that people in relativity had been interested in for a long time before. So these are called the Tau-Bolt metrics. So these typically live on disk bundles over Riemann surfaces. Let's say a Riemann surface of genus L. So you take any Riemann surface of genus L, you take a disk bundle of charge K, and anyway, this is one of these terrible puns. I don't know, you know, the background. So if you're looking at Ricci flat metrics, these were called Taub-Nut, and that was an acronym. And then, well, it took me about 2 years to get the pun, but nuts and bolts, I'm slow. Okay, so anyway, there's a long list of examples, and it turns out that for most of these, you can compute the degree and it's non-zero. So you have a lot of examples of sort of very large families of metrics where this boundary problem is, in some sense, well posed. There are a lot of things that aren't well understood. For example, For example, on the four ball itself, it's very natural to suspect that, I mean, so a question, which is still open, and I'm beginning to suspect it probably is not true, is if you look at this on the four ball, to see, and maybe I'll just even restrict here. So is this an isomorphism? I suspect it's probably not true. What's going to happen is they're probably going to be folds near the boundary, but like I say, this isn't known yet. Okay, what about some other existence results? So a theorem that it's probably easier to draw a picture of than anything else. This is, again, a fairly soft theorem. So there are a number of examples that one can prove by various modifications of gluing methods. Let me just list two of them. One is a boundary-connected sum theorem. So suppose I have, here's an M1 and an M2, and these can have some sort of topology. You know, they can be doing whatever, but they're both Poincaré-Einstein metrics. One can find a new metric which, in some sense, is a small perturbation of the conformal class on the boundary, and which somehow fills this in with an Einstein metric. So connected sums of Einstein metrics are impossible to do, in fact. I mean, it's known that they're topological obstructions. So it was somewhat of a surprise that there's sort of a nice candidate for a bridge here, and it allows you to do this construction. How you prove these results, well, again, there's sort of a lot of technology for doing these sorts of things at this point in time. You know, you find approximate solutions, and you perturb off of them to exact solutions. And the analytic problem you're facing is that, well, first of all, you know, the operator is degenerate everywhere on this boundary. We already saw that one should be able to deal with it. But then you're dealing with a family of problems where the geometry is pinching off. So there are some issues to be faced, but they're quite manageable. A consequence of this is something that's, well, almost quite proved here. So again, we'll go back to dimension 4. Here's an old theorem of Shane and Yao from the late 70s. So if, let's say, Y3 has a metric of scalar, has a metric of positive scalar curvature, then Y is necessarily of the form, well, it's going to look like a finite connected sum of manifolds, where each of these manifolds are sort of primitive things of this type, and they're of two types. So each yj either has finite fundamental group, or is a quotient of S2 cross S1. Here you should think of Lens spaces. Right, finite quotients of spheres. Unfortunately, this relies on two big conjectures, you know, the spherical spaceform conjecture and the Poincaré conjecture. So this is probably what's happening here, but nobody knows. Here we know what all of these things are. And so the question is, suppose you take any manifold of positive scalar curvature, namely anything that arises in this form, can you fill it with Poincaré-Einstein metrics? Right, so do all of these sort of physically stable situations really arise in practice? And, well, again, modulo this uncertainty of what these things are, this construction here allows you to say that that's true. Okay, so what you need to do is exhibit explicit fillings of all of these quotients of S2 cross S1 and of at least all of the Lens spaces. And, well, in the interest of time, I won't state it, but there's another theorem which in some sense allows you to fill Lens spaces, and it uses essentially a construction from algebraic geometry plus some work that goes back to Kronheimer to sort of allow you to resolve those singularities. So I won't say more about that right now. So the upshot of this is that it seems very likely that in the four-dimensional situation, any manifold for which this is non-empty has fillings. So that was sort of one of my big goals of doing this. Okay, let me see. So there are various things. Excuse me? Absolutely. So the boundary becomes, so if M1 has boundary Y1 and M2 has boundary Y2, then the boundary of this new thing is the connected sum of those two manifolds. Right. So in some sense, what you're doing here is you say, suppose that you know how to fill all these primitive guys. then this construction tells you how to fill their connected sums. Right, but that's what this connected sum is. That's exactly what this construction is doing. Okay, well, let me tell you a few other things that are known. As I say, there's sort of a lot that can be said. So let me say a little bit about the regularity theory. I won't go very deeply into this. So this is something that really comes down to, you know, some fairly strenuous PDE work. And it starts off with the formal picture, the formal expansion. And this was discovered by Beffman and Graham. So there are two possible types of expansion. So you remember that G, I've put in some sort of normal form, the x squared plus h over x squared. Here, h is a family of metrics on the boundary, so I can expand that, at least putatively, in some sort of Taylor series, xh1 plus x squared h2, so on. So h naught is my initial metric I started with, and these are sort of higher order expansions in the Taylor series. What Fefferman and Graham originally realized was that this Ricci curvature equation essentially corresponds to a regular singular equation on these coefficients. So roughly speaking, all coefficients are determined formally from just two of them. The two being H0 and HN. So these are like the two indicial roots for this regular singular problem are 0 and n. These are the two formally free coefficients. There's some sort of, you can think of this as a Dirichlet-Neumann operator or some sort of scattering data, namely, given H0, there's some sort of nonlinear global relationship which tells you what Hn is. Okay. So the exact expansion that they calculated, sort of assuming that there was some expansion, then you can nail down what all the powers and coefficients are, and there are two cases. So one is when n is even, and then one has h looks like h0 plus x squared h2 plus, well, then you're going to get to a term x to the n hn, and then, see, n being even, right, then x to the n log x, hn tilde, and then you have every power beyond there plus higher and higher powers of log as you go further out. But you only have even powers going up to here. And when n is odd, for example, in four dimensions, when n is 3, because of my indexing, then h looks like h0 plus x squared h2. So all even powers until you come to the first odd power, and then it continues on with just smooth powers. Okay, so as I say, this is a formal expansion, and it's just recent work with Rob and Graham. One actually can prove that these expansions are real, and it's a regularity term for this nonlinear problem. And again, it's not, one has to set it up the correct way, but it follows in the end from the linear regularity theory for these degenerate equations. But in fact, one gets a little bit more out of this, so one can actually take this mapping, E of M, these expansions hold. And the mapping E of M to, well, pairs of tensors. So let me just write this if I have any G. And I map it to the pair H0HN. This is an embedding. So this means the following, that if I think of the set of all pairs, H0HN, then the set of pairs which are realized by actual fillings, well, it forms some sort of nonlinear manifold like this, and this conformal infinity map I've talked about is really just the projection in this space. So I have some, in fact, it turns out to be a Lagrangian submanifold in a suitable sense of this infinite dimensional space, this is some sort of nonlinear Dirichlet-Neumann operator which tells you the relationship between these things. This is probably the most convenient way to think about this moduli space. Okay, so these are all structural issues about what the totality of these metrics look like. Let me just conclude by mentioning a few theorems and applications of these things. As I say, the story is sort of a long one. I'm just trying to give you a bit of the feel for it. One is a very pretty theorem. So this is an obstruction to existence. This is a paper of Witten and Yao about, I don't know, 3-4 years ago at this point, which is assuming that we're in this physically stable case again. So suppose that I have mg, well, let me write it this way. Suppose g is in e plus of m. Namely, it has scalar positive conformal infinity. So it has a, it's one of these physically stable Poincaré-Einstein metrics. Right. Then they proved that h lower n of m, well, boundary m, is equal to 0. And that's the same as saying that the boundary of m is connected. So if you have a disconnected boundary, then you can't have scalar positive conformal infinities. An example of where this goes wrong is in three dimensions. So hyperbolic metrics are the only things that occur in three dimensions, just because Einstein means constant curvature in three dimensions. And there's a well-known class of manifolds, these Fuchsian manifolds in three dimensions. I take any Riemann surface, the hyperbolic metric, and there's a certain warp product construction. So this is genus 2 or higher. I won't write down the specific metric, but if I take a hyperbolic metric on a compact Riemann surface, then there's a way of extending that to a hyperbolic metric on a manifold that has two exponentially growing ends like this. It turns out to be in exactly this type of geometry. Okay, disconnected boundary, but, well, the boundary metrics are negative. They're scalar negative, not scalar positive. So the rationale for this result is, let me just sort of say it briefly, is that suppose that here's the boundary. So here's the boundary of M. And suppose that you try to find a hypersurface which is isotopic to the boundary, but which minimizes a certain functional. So the functional you want to look at, so if this hypersurface is sigma, you want to minimize the volume of sigma minus N times, well, essentially the area of this interior here. This is a well-defined functional. You can find a minimizer just by standard techniques of geometric measure theory. And then using the scalar positivity of the boundary, you can prove that, well, if you'd have a stable minimizer, it would have to satisfy some unacceptable geometric properties. So it can't exist unless it's contracted all the way to zero. So another thing that comes out of this expansion, which again followed from a suggestion from the string theorists, was something called the renormalized volume. So clearly these manifolds are exponentially growing. They have infinite volume. But you can talk about what's called the renormalized volume. And it's defined essentially as following. You look at the volume form of this metric, and you integrate just over, well, some finite piece of this, where the defining function x is greater than or equal to epsilon. Okay, well, as epsilon gets smaller, this is blowing up. And you can actually compute based on these expansions. You can compute exactly what happens. This has an asymptotic expansion, and it's going to look, let's say, like a C0 x to the epsilon to the minus n plus C2 epsilon to the minus n plus 2 plus, and so on. And you just perform the Audemars regularization on this. You throw away all the singular terms, and you just take the first finite term. Okay? No reason why this should be well defined, and somewhat remarkably, because of the Einstein condition, it is. So so the Audemars regularization. Just by throwing away all the singular terms here, is well defined when n is odd. When n is even, there's a slightly different story here. There's a log term in this expansion, and the coefficient of the log is well-defined. And the coefficient of the constant term turns out to have a nice conformal transformation rule. So so this is a rather weird quantity. So this is called the, you know, you can call it the volume of mg, or the renormalized volume of mg. And so again, this is something that is supposed to be some sort of action in physics, and it's really not very well understood. I mean, there it is. It's well-defined. And one of the things that seems to be working out well is this boundary connected sum theorem, which I've now erased here, allows you to study this renormalized volume, and one can prove a few results about it, some positive, some negative. So theorems include that this renormalized volume is not proper on the moduli space, but it is unbounded. So sort of a hope that people had of, you know, finding critical metrics for this volume is almost certain to fail. I mean, there, you know, it's hard to know if there's enough topology, but the sort of Morse theory structure of these is just going to be a mess. So it's not going to be necessarily so easy to find find critical points of these things. Anyway, I think I'll stop there, but I'll discuss.